Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
When it comes to hiring, don't go searching for the one. Just meet your match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
At a rally in North Dakota last night, President Trump said that he wants his pick for the Supreme Court to stay on the court for 40 or 45 years. Even more disturbing, he added, or until the end of my presidency, whichever comes first.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. On today's show, Seth talks to Stacey Abrams, the Democratic nominee in the Georgia governor's race. Abrams also keeps the conversation going backstage at Studio 8G just for this podcast. But first, a closer look.
Republicans are rushing to replace retiring Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy while simultaneously working to stop the Russia investigation. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. Trump held yet another campaign rally last night in North Dakota, his third rally in a week. Now, we've been calling these rallies public therapy sessions, but it was never more true than it was last night. Watch as Trump airs his deepest insecurities about not being seen as smart, rich, or popular.
I meet these people. They call them the elite. These people. I look at them. I say, that's elite? We got more money, we got more brains, we got better houses, apartments, we got nicer boats, we're smarter than they are. And they say, the elite, we're the elite. And I thought that was so brilliant. I said, oh, I am so smart. I am the smartest person. My uncle was a great professor at MIT for 40 years. Can you believe 40 years? I said, but I'm smarter than him. I'm smarter than anybody. A thing comes out, a big poll and a couple of polls, a number of polls, that he's the most powerful, most popular Republican in the history of the party.
Oh, my God, dude, get a therapist. I know you're cheap, but get a therapist. Trump is like a guy at a bar who acts as his own wingman.
My buddy thinks you're cute. He's smart and handsome and popular, and he's me.
But you know what Trump says? He's smarter than anybody, and he had a chance to show off those smarts while talking about the complex issue of trade during his rally. Trump was defending his tariffs. Now, this is Trump's thing. It's his big issue, the thing he claims to be an expert on. And yet, when his aides slipped him a note during the rally about Canadian wheat practices, he seemed confused.
I'll tell you, John and Kevin gave me something. They just told me this. Canadian wheat markets consistently discriminate against the United States wheat by grading it as feed. Do you know what that means? They know what it means. I don't know what the hell it means. I just know it's a bad deal. What the hell does that mean? Yeah.
Great, that clears it up. Also, he yells out Canadian wheat like he's guessing in Pictionary. Canadian wheat! Only Trump could brag that he's smarter than anybody and then in the same speech admit that he has no idea what he's talking about. He's Like a doctor looking down at you before surgery who says, don't worry, I'm the best surgeon in the world. Now just tell me, what does a kidney look like? While he was nursing his various obsessions, Trump decided to return to another one, perhaps his greatest obsession, Hillary Clinton, during a rant comparing the size of his crowds to hers.
If crooked Hillary would have won this election, and if she came here, which is about a 0% chance, after the election, she'd have 200 people in a conference room in a small hotel. And let me tell you, if our opponent, our wonderful opponent, when is she going to get over it? When does she get over it?
When is she going to get over it? If you're still asking that question 20 months after the election you won, you're the person who's not over it. Trump's like a guy texting his ex 2 years after they broke up, why can't you stop thinking about me? And while Trump is obsessing over Hillary or his popularity, he also seems to have found a new hobby horse. How much, bear with me here, how much rich guys love rockets? He's mentioned it multiple times just in the last week while discussing his plans for NASA, including twice yesterday.
I said, listen, you got rich guys, for whatever reason, they love rockets. I said, lease them the land, charge them a lot, but let's do it that way. That's a lot better. We're like a landlord. We have all these rich guys. They love rockets. They're all sending up Bezos and Elon Musk and all of them. They love the rocket business. Let them just rent it to them for a lot of money and let them play. You know, they need our land. It's good to be in the real estate business. They need our land. You know, we have rich guys. They love these rockets. I said, lease them the land, charge them a lot. They just want to send rockets. But I look at it with Bezos, with Elon Musk. They all love rockets.
He sounds like a stand-up comic trying out a new bet. What's the deal with rich guys and rockets? Seriously, though, why on earth would anyone want their own personal rocket? I mean, sure, things are bad right now, but it's not like anyone actually wishes they could blast themselves into outer space, right?
Breaking news.
We're following major breaking news. President Trump getting another opportunity to put his stamp on the United States Supreme Court for decades to come. Justice Anthony Kennedy announcing his retirement a few hours ago.
Hey, honey, it's me. Meet me at the launch pad in T-minus 20 minutes. No, don't bring the dog! So, Donald Little Rocket Man Trump will now have the chance to nominate a second Supreme Court justice who will shape the future of everything from gay rights to voting rights to Roe v. Wade. Trump, of course, is elated that he gets to pick a second Supreme Court justice who could help cement his legacy, and he made that clear yesterday when he was meeting with the president of Portugal. But right off the bat, he had to go and make it weird.
If you don't mind, I'll just make a quick statement of a man I also have great respect for, Justice Anthony. You know who I'm talking about. Justice Kennedy will be retiring.
He definitely forgot Kennedy's last name for a second. Justice Anthony, you know who I'm talking about. Old guy glasses. You know him, black robe. How do you forget the name Kennedy? It's one of the most famous names in American history. Is that why Trump puts his names on all his buildings so he won't forget it? My name is Donald. Donald Tower. Now, if you remember, Republicans stole a Supreme Court seat from President Obama by staging an unprecedented blockade of Obama's choice to fill the seat, Merrick Garland. They claimed back then that the American people should get to weigh in during the presidential election, which was, at the time, 9 months away.
The American people should be afforded the opportunity to weigh in.
We think that the American people need a chance to weigh in on this issue.
And ought to be put off out of this toxic arena right now and put off to after the election.
This should be a decision for the people, George. Let the election decide it.
Let's let the American people decide.
There you go. McConnell said, let the people decide. So now that we're 4 months away from an election, I'm sure McConnell, a man of his word, will follow the rule he made up and hold off a vote until after the election. And I'm just kidding. McConnell was totally full of
We will vote to confirm Justice Kennedy's successor this fall. It's imperative that the president's nominee be considered fairly.
Considered fairly? You refuse to even meet with Merrick Garland. Look at that sweet man. That's like refusing to pet a golden retriever.
No, thank you. I prefer a rattlesnake. I like to pet a good old rattlesnake. Come here now. Not a snake.
Here's the lesson. The GOP isn't operating on arguments or principles. They don't care about being called hypocrites or liars. Hypocrisy isn't their weakness, it's their platform. We saw that yet again during a congressional hearing on the Russia investigation today. Remember, Republicans spent millions of dollars over 4 years investigating Benghazi and came up with nothing. And yet today, they basically yelled at Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein to end the Russia investigation. Here's retiring GOP Congressman Trey Gowdy freaking out at Rosenstein today.
We're 2 years into this investigation. We're a year and a half into the presidency. We're over a year into special counsel. There's a presumption of guilt. There's a desire by Democrat senators to fundraise off of your investigation. More than 60 Democrats have already voted to proceed with impeachment before Bob Mueller has found a single solitary damn thing. More than 60 have voted to move forward with impeachment, and he hasn't presented his first finding. If you have evidence of wrongdoing by any member of the Trump campaign, present it to the damn grand jury. Whatever you got, finish it the hell up.
What's up with Trey Gowdy? I mean, look at him. Loose tie, messy hair. He looks like he's about to be cut off by the bartender. They're trying to impeach him! Of course, Gowdy's the same guy who dragged Hillary Clinton in front of a committee to testify about Benghazi during the presidential campaign. And even he admitted after that hearing that he didn't learn anything new.
Well, when you say new today, I mean, we knew some of that already. We knew about the emails. In terms of her testimony, I don't know that she testified that much differently today than she has the previous time she's testified. So I'd have to go back and look at the transcript.
Go back and look at the transcript. Even the transcript would be fed up. Establishment Democrats need to learn that Republicans don't care about being hypocrites. It's just raw politics. Trump doesn't care for your respect, for rules or norms. In fact, there's only one thing Trump does seem to deeply care about.
Rich guys, they love rockets.
This has been a closer look. Democratic nominee for governor of Georgia, her book, Minority Leader, How to Lead from the Outside and Make Real Change, is available now. Please welcome to the show, Stacey Abrams, everyone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, my God, you have some fans here. I know this is a very busy time for you. Obviously, you are campaigning. And not only are you campaigning, but if you were to win this election, you would be the first African-American female governor in this country. So this is a very...
I could tell.
You have received national attention for your strategy in Georgia. You have made it clear that you are not trying to flip Trump voters or attract Republican votes. You are focusing on Democratic turnout and attracting new voters. What brought you to this strategy?
Math,
okay.
I mean, look, I want every vote that I can get. But what I've seen happen for the last few years is that you've had candidates who pretend to be something they're not, trying to convince those who do not agree with them that somehow this time it's real. My approach is every Democratic voter we can get, especially those who don't think their voices matter, and independent thinkers who realize they are heading down the wrong path if they don't vote for a Democrat this time. And there are enough of us to win an election.
And is this... Do you feel, is it something you get pushback on? Do people at a level of maybe at the party level say to you, no, that the key to moving forward is convincing people who voted for Donald Trump that you are the answer?
If you go back before I won the primary, there were lots of stories about how wrongheaded I was and how this is a novel strategy to win voters who agree with you. and to talk to voters to get them to agree with you. And then to tell them to agree with you, they should vote. That is our field strategy. And there has been some pushback because we want to believe that it's easier to get those who vote all the time. But the reality is the people who do not vote don't vote because we haven't given them a reason to vote. They haven't heard their issues reflected in the candidates. And my responsibility is to have conversations, to talk about my personal debt, because debt is not new in America, to talk about the challenges my brother, who faces mental health challenges and drug addiction challenges, who's making his life anew after coming out of jail. We need to talk about him because my brother is other people's brothers. We have to talk about medical access, and we have to talk about all of these things so that people know there's a reason to take time off from your second shift at your third job to go and cast a ballot.
Now, you do not know your opponent yet. There is still a runoff election for the Republican. One of the two has this campaign ad.
Yes.
I think it was an attempt to be humorous. The ad was that this was a boy who was interested in his daughter, and in the ad, he's pointing a gun at him. Now, when you see that, do you think, oh, this is great, I'm going to make hay with this, or do you look at that and go, oh, boy, I don't know?
I do know him. And what I would say is, as someone who learned how to shoot when I was growing up in Mississippi, the first thing you learn is you don't do that. That firearm 101 is don't point it at people.
Yeah.
Because firearm 102 is you go to prison. So you keep it pointed down or, it is an interesting approach to try to convince people they can trust you with their lives.
That is a good way of putting it. I want to talk about your book. So you wrote this book, Minority Leader. This is about, the challenges you faced, reaching out to communities who maybe feel underrepresented when it comes to the electoral process. Not the first book you have written.
No, it is not.
And the other books you have written were under a pen name.
Yes.
What was your pen name?
So I also wrote as Selena Montgomery.
And what did Selena Montgomery write?
She wrote romantic suspense novels.
So now, what made you use a pen name when writing that?
So I wrote my first romantic suspense novel while I was a third-year student at Yale Law School. Mm-hmm. I also wrote a scintillating article on the operational dissonance of the unrelated business income tax exemption.
Okay.
And they were coming out at the same time. Google was just a thing. And it seemed to me that no one would read a romance novel by Alan Greenspan.
Right.
So I came up with a second name.
So you said, by the way, it seems like if you were writing the tax one,
yes,
you wouldn't have time to write the suspenseful romance one. How did you multitask to get them both done?
I am very flexible in my writing styles.
Okay, gotcha. Yes. I do want to ask about Rules of Engagement. Yes. This is your first book?
This is my very first book.
Okay, and what was the inspiration for Rules of Engagement?
My ex-boyfriend, I read his dissertation. He's a chemical physicist. We were still friendly at the time he sent it to me. We're still friendly now, too, let me be clear. But at the time, I read his dissertation, and he had this interesting chemical, and it became the premise of the book. What I decided to do was to make it a spy novel. But I remembered I was angry with him, so he languishes in prison in this book for the rest of his life.
And did you find that cathartic?
It was very cathartic.
Okay, gotcha. And he didn't even know. He was like, I thought I was dating Stacy, not Selena.
Well, I did send him a copy of the book. When I was telling him about the premise, he was like, none of these things are true. And I'm like, this is why we broke up, because you have no imagination.
Should you win, you will have a national platform. As a governor from a state house, how do you address the Trump presidency? How do you address issues like the travel ban that was upheld today?
Well, I will say this. One of the things I talk about in Minority Leader is the necessity of giving voice to those who feel voiceless. And the travel ban is a perfect example of why a governor is so important. We have to have moral leadership in this country, and people have to hear themselves talked about, especially in the face of the abomination that we see happening in the White House every day. And for me, the opportunity is to use the position of the governor, especially in the Deep South, to say you're welcome, that you belong, and that there are people who are looking out for you. And 2020 is coming.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being here.
Welcome.
Yeah, of course.
So my digital team. So I have an amazing digital team, and I promised them that I would, number one, say you are so awesome and so smart.
Oh,
and I mean
so
it.
Kind
I mean
of
it.
You to say
but
thanks.
Number two, I have to say StacyAbrams.com is my website in case people want to learn more about me.
Okay, StacyAbrams.com. There you go. Minority Leaders is available now.
Hi, this is Henry from Late Night. I'm here with Stacey Abrams, the Democratic nominee for governor of Georgia. When did you first get interested in politics, and when did you then make the decision that the governorship was the most important role that you wanted to pursue?
I've been interested. First of all, thank you for having me.
We're so happy you're here.
Well, it's my pleasure. You know, I first became interested in politics when I was younger. Mm-hmm. I was more interested in policy and trying to figure out why my family still, you know, was mired in poverty, why communities that needed help weren't getting help. And my parents explained that, you know, while we were doing direct service and volunteerism, that really to do a larger solution, you needed good government. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to find government and make it work better.
I imagine you were kind of one of the outlier with your friends. Like, few people when their children want to be in government. Was that the case?
When I was in second grade, the only fight I've ever gotten into in school was with another student who voted for, we did the sort of mock election. She voted for Reagan, I voted for Carter, and we got into a really deep fight about whether or not, you know, who was better. So I've cared about politics for a very long time.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I was a bit of an outlier.
Right. I've heard you talk about, originally you were kind of interested years back in being mayor of Atlanta.
Yes.
Why did you think the governorship is a role you wanted to pursue kind of instead?
I've always recognized that the statewide elected officials had greater power. A lot of focusing on mayor was because the only jobs I'd ever seen African Americans achieve, the highest rank was mayor. And a mayor can do extraordinary things. And I had the privilege of working for Maynard Jackson in his third term, for Shirley Franklin when she became mayor. But I realized working with Mayor Franklin more than anyone that my capacity to run for governor was greater, and that the capacity to do more for the city of Atlanta and other communities would be achieved if I were the governor of Georgia.
Right. In your campaign for the governor of Georgia, you talk a lot about the importance of field. Can you first explain what the word field means in politics and why it is so kind of fundamental to your race?
Sure. So for those who do not care about the way political campaigns work, there are three areas. Communications, which is talking to you in general. Field, which is coming to your door and talking to you specifically, and television, which is talking at you on television. And so, and you know, television is important because it often reminds people there's an election, it illuminates or repeats information. But field is about the one-on-one contact. It's the difference between someone sending you a mass postcard or someone knocking on your door saying, "Hi, I want to know you." Field is how you get to know folks, and people feel engaged and are more likely to vote if you actually bother to engage them directly.
Yeah. How much of your day is overseeing field now, is dealing with fundraising, is dealing with communications? I mean, you are the candidate, you're the head of the campaign. How do you spend your days?
I have an extraordinary team. I have the most amazing campaign manager, Lauren Groargo. I have an extraordinary team of people who run the gamut in age, in race, in region, in political philosophy. We're all Democrats, but we come from all the wings of the party.
Is that important to you to have kind of all those views, at least within the party?
Absolutely, because we cannot win this election without engaging every single like-minded voter.
Yeah.
But you can't get to them if you don't know what they're thinking.
Right.
So my job is to raise the money to pay for them to eat every day and to pay for field teams because Georgia's a huge state. We need lots of folks to go out and knock on those doors to raise money so we can go on television, but also go on Facebook, do digital ads, go on the radio, send mail. My job is to raise the money to make certain that everyone hears our campaign.
Right. I read a story about you that when you were younger, you were a teenager, you went up to the governor's mansion, and this was kind of a moment that kind of spurred your interest in running for politics and ultimately getting to the governor's mansion. Can you tell that story?
Sure. So my parents moved us from Mississippi to Georgia when I was a junior in high school. My senior year, I graduated as valedictorian of that high school. In Georgia, you are invited to meet the governor when you're the valedictorian. So I was very excited. My parents and I got dressed up and ready to go. But when we moved from Mississippi to Georgia, the old station wagon we had died and my parents couldn't afford a new car. So we used public transit. Well, the day we went to the governor's mansion, we had to take the bus. Yeah. And we arrived at the governor's mansion. We got off the bus. We had to walk up the driveway. And the guard who was admitting all the folks driving in looked at me, looked at my family, and told us it was a private event and we didn't belong. He didn't check his checklist. He didn't ask us for our invitation. He just made an assumption. Right. That led my father to push back. And then when he still didn't let us in, led to a very engaged and vigorous discussion with my parents and the guard. Mm-hmm. And eventually he let us in. But what I remember from that day is not meeting the governor, not meeting my fellow valedictorians. I remember this man in front of the most powerful place in Georgia who looked at me looked at my transportation, told himself a story, and decided I didn't belong in that space. And I intend to take that space back.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of people rooting for you. Good luck. Thank you so much for being here. This is such a pleasure.
For anyone who's listening, we'd love to have you engage in our campaign. StacyAbrams.com. We have national volunteers from across the country because this is... It's a Georgia race, but we are a national campaign because we want everyone to understand that we can win if we reflect our values and do the work together.
Yeah. You've talked about the campaign as you're running a test, which I think is really interesting. You're doing the thing Democrats said we need to do, but many are afraid to do.
Yes.
Yeah.
I plan to test it out and I plan to be right.
Hope so. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much,
Henry. A pleasure.
I appreciate it.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
I love a good parasocial relationship with a celebrity who will probably never know my name.
I mean, honestly, who knows? Don't count yourself out. But my favorite part about these feuds is how they're ignited by the tiniest things.
Jada, I love you. G.I. Jane 2, can't wait to see it.
I accidentally laminated my brows too much.
It starts small and then it gets so big.
To be honest, Naomi, I'm fearful of you to this day.
I don't know her.
We all just have to admit, we're addicted. Everybody has opinions. Everyone picks sides.
Leave Britney Spears alone right now.
From Wondery, I'm Sydney Battle.
And I'm Matt Bellassai.
And this is Dis and Tell, la, la, la. Where we unpack why we get so invested in these feuds and whether or not our attention only makes the whole thing worse.
Follow Dis and Tell wherever you get your podcasts.